In today's episode, we are recording live from the Whitworth Art Gallery with a special introduction from Radio 5 Live's Chris Warburton.
And it's brilliant to see so many people here. So yeah, my name's Chris Warburton. I present the weekend breakfast programme on Radio 5 Live. So unlike all of you, I've been up since 3:30 this morning. Yeah, I know, I look good on it, right? I've been in radio for about 20 years, and I am a reporter on The One Show as well, on BBC One, you know that show, right? And I also make podcasts, which is kind of why I've got a little bit involved with these guys. And you're probably thinking, what the hell are you doing here anyway? But part of the reason is I wanted to try and give a little bit of support to these wonderful people who are doing brilliant things and fantastically committed to what they're doing around the Rare project. And we had a little sit down a few weeks ago, didn't we, for a couple of hours talking about podcasts and all that kind of stuff. And they're gearing up for this podcast recording, which is going to be really, really interesting as well. I sort of thought when I first did my job, my first ever job was with the BBC in Cambridge, BBC Radio Cambridgeshire, 20 years ago, and they were talking about mapping the genome. And I was thinking, okay, what is this? What is this thing? And then it was explained to me, and I thought, that sounds like an awful lot of hard work. And then you get to the end of it, and you think, well, they've done it. And listening to these guys in a little bit, I think it's going to be absolutely fascinating. But also, trying to break things down and explain quite complex ideas in quite simple ways, which is what we try and do on the radio as well. Let's get to the recording. I'll stop prattling on. This is episode 5, and it's going to be great because we've got the kids involved as well. What's your name?
Karis.
And?
Heidi.
And?
Iris.
Iris, good. Nice loud voices, that's what we need, right? Yeah. They're going to be talking about how rare are you, which is a really interesting question, I think, and they'll be discussing the human genome with the patients of tomorrow, which are these guys, and exploring some of the ethical issues around it. So it's going to be good. Looking forward to it. Thanks very much.
I don't really know what to say now because Chris was so good. There's a lot of pressure. We're very excited to be at the Whitworth. Myself and Marie Angels, and this is our 4th recording, but the first time that we've done it ever in front of other people that are not looking through a glass at us. Is that better?
Yes.
Yes, good. So we're at the Whitworth, and in this episode, myself and Marie Angels will be chatting to Sasha Henriquez and George Bagel. And of course, our lovely other guests, which are Iris, Keris, and Heidi. And we're going to just ask you to introduce yourselves a little bit and tell us why you're here, if that's okay. You're a bit nervous. I am. You're nervous. I'm really nervous. Okay, so we'll start with you, Keris. So if you, Iris. So if you could tell us why you're here, Iris.
I'm here because I wanted to come here because I like doing art and stuff, and I like going to do activities.
And did you enter the art competition?
No.
But have you seen all the lovely work downstairs?
A little bit of it.
And what about yourself? Why are you here today?
Because I entered the Rare art competition and I wanted to see my work.
And what did you draw?
I drew a family of rainbows with some black clouds.
Can you tell me a little bit why that was rare to you?
Because it's impossible to do and I like impossible things.
Nice. And what about yourself?
I came because of the Rare art competition and I entered it with my school and I drew a picture of Nyan Cat.
And what school do you go to?
St. Andrews.
Nice. And why was your picture particularly rare? What did you made you think of it as rare?
Because I'd never seen it before.
Nice. Great. Well, thank you for introducing yourselves. We'll be doing a lot of talking, but we'll occasionally, you guys can join in whenever you want to. Yeah. So now we'll turn to you guys. So Sasha, if you could introduce yourself and tell us how you got to here.
Big question.
Yeah, start with the big one.
Okay. So my name's Sasha, obviously, and I'm a genetic counsellor over at St. Mary's Hospital, which is across the street. I've been there for about 8 or 9 years as a genetic counsellor, but I started off doing kind of patient engagement and science communication. So as part of my work as a genetic counsellor, I'm always really interested to have the conversation with everyone about what science means to us and how we can use it in our lives. And so that's why I was really interested to be involved with you guys and come and do some activities here today.
And could you tell everyone, because not many people might know, mm-hmm. what a genetic counsellor is and where we might meet you, where would we see you?
Another big question. How much time have we got?
2 minutes.
So in 2 minutes. So a genetic counsellor, as I said, works as part of a genetic medicine department. So we see people who have been affected by a genetic condition in their family. And that might be them having a genetic condition themselves, them having a child with a genetic condition, or having a pregnancy that's affected by a genetic condition. So often people will come to us either from another part of medicine, so maybe from a cancer service, or from a paediatrician or a neurologist, or they might be referred via a GP because they're worried about something in their family. So they see me to kind of explain a bit about the science and understand it, and that helps them make a decision about what they want to do now that that thing has happened in their life. So I meet people in pregnancy, as grandparents, as parents, parents of children, kind of all through their lives and with all different parts of the family as well.
I'm sure we will talk a little bit more about that, but because there is young people here, yes. I just wonder if you would like to be a genetic counsellor, mm-hmm. what do you need to do?
So I guess technically, if you wanted to be a genetic counsellor, we're all from science-y type backgrounds. So we've all kind of done science before we became genetic counsellors. So I was really interested in science when I was a young person. I walked around with a science encyclopedia. But I always knew that I didn't really want to work in a lab. So even though I did science as a degree, I was really bored in the laboratory. And what I really like, as you can tell, is talking to people. So I then worked for a charity with families who were affected by rare conditions. And that's how I learned about what a genetic counsellor is, really. And so it's kind of a mixture of being interested in science, but also being interested in helping people. And those two things are what bring people to genetic counselling.
Thank you. And George?
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. So my name is George, and I'm a clinical scientist in genomics, working also at St. Mary's at the Manchester Centre for Genomic Medicine. What do you want to say?
You seem to have brought something quite big with you today.
Yes, I have.
Everybody's been asking me about, and I've not really been able to articulate what that is.
Yes.
So could you tell us what you've brought with you today?
Yes. So I brought with myself a lot of books. So I've had a lot of people helping me in the morning to move these books from the hospital over to here. And they're basically, if you all heard of the DNA, that's what we brought with us is the printed copy of the human genome. So the human genome is all of the DNA in our body. It's a very, very big library, and we have a printed copy of it. So we've printed all the letters of the DNA into a library, and we brought it here with us.
Now, how long has that taken to print all the letters of the DNA?
So the project of itself of getting these books done and ready and printed took around 2.5 to 3 years. Yes, lots of work. Lots of excited people working on it.
Can I ask why? Why that?
So when we did, so as a scientist, we spend most of our time in the lab, and we don't see many people. I know Sasha was bored in the lab, but we do lots of fun things.
I was bored, it's not boring.
In the lab. But we don't see patients, and because of that, it's lovely to do public engagement, go and see people and talk to them. And when we talk to them about the human genome, we always set stories about how big the human genome is. And people loved it. You will tell them, if we print the human genome, it will take you 99 years to read, or if you want to type the human genome and you're a very fast typist, it will take you 50 years to type. And we always give these facts, and people love hearing about them. And one day we were thinking, well, what actually if we print the human genome, and then people can see with their own eyes how big is the human genome? Because that's where we do our work. We spend our time looking at the DNA of the human genome, the letters of the human genome, to try and find the changes that Sasha and others counsel patients about that might make us unwell, give us cancer or rare disease or anything like that.
And did that start in Manchester? Did the idea come out of Manchester or?
So we're not the first printed human genome in the UK. There are actually two other copies. So when we had the idea, I went and Googled and we found two copies, and Leicester were kind enough to lend us their copy. So we drove a big car down to Leicester. It was when they won the Premier League, so they were very happy and feeling generous. And we put all the books in the back of the car, we drove them back, and we presented them in a pub as part of an event called Pint of Science, which happens every year. It's an international event. And the reaction of people to the human genome, the printed copy, was amazing. So we decided, well, let's do it ourselves. Let's have a copy in Manchester. And we will make it Manchester special.
And how important is it for both of you, actually, that people are engaged, that you know, society is kind of... Why do they need to see the human genome, do you think? What's important about that?
So, first of all, the human genome is all of our DNA. So it's not owned by scientists, it's not owned by genetic counselors, it's everyone's DNA. And I think because we share a lot of it, it's important for people to engage with it, to learn about it, because it affects the lives of everyone around us. Everyone is affected one way or another by the human genome.
And Sasha, in terms of people understanding that, how do you communicate that to everyone, that the human genome is, you know, that we're all affected, and although we're kind of different, we're all the same, or mm-hmm. how do you kind of get that message across, particularly to young children?
Mm-hmm. So I think it's really interesting, because there are, sometimes you need kind of physical things, so actually that's what's really great about what George has done, is that for some people's understanding, they actually really need to just see what that means when we're talking about this theoretical thing called the human genome. And I think not just for young people, for everyone that comes to the clinic, it's a really abstract idea what it means that we all have this code, and a very small change in this code can be the thing that's caused a very big thing to happen in your life. And so we use pictures, we talk about it being a library, we talk about beads on a necklace, we talk about making a recipe like a cake. So there are all different ways that we talk about genetic information. And once people are able to kind of hold that and understand what that means, it really empowers them to be able to make decisions about what they do with their data, who uses that, how they can use that to help themselves and help their families. So, I mean, it just runs through every kind of branch of medicine and what we do. So I think it's really important for us as a population to kind of know about our own DNA.
And then to bring, I myself have a very close connection to my genetic counsellor still. She can't get rid of me. my youngest daughter's 6 and I still write to her an email. But how important, once we have that information,
yes.
and sometimes it can be life-changing, yes. either in a positive way or in a, you know, how important is it that we get the support around that information that's not just the science but the kind of the other support?
Yeah, and that's really essential. I was talking to someone today about kind of what we do, and I guess it's an appreciation that whatever happens in our lives, we are still human at the centre of it. We are still people. We still have families. We still have friends. We still have dreams and aspirations, and it's about how what has happened interjects into that and how that might change how you want to live your life, or how that might reinforce the things that you want to keep. So it really is about kind of understanding what the impact of that is on you as an individual. And everybody's different or unique in that way. So it's a real privilege for me, because I have to spend some time to get to know who you are, what's important to you, what matters about this information for you.
I don't want to go too far away of yourselves before we kind of go into what you're doing.
Okay.
So you kind of mentioned how you arrived to where you are, but how long you knew you kind of be doing this kind of job? Any of you, you know?
Story time.
Can I bring us back 1 second because of a question asked and a story?
You don't want to go.
You know, why was it important again to print the human genome? And actually, in one of the events, we had a patient with a very rare disease. And she took part of the 100,000 genome, which you've had in one of the previous podcasts, and she said she was always upset about how long it took for her to learn her results. Mm. She said she now understands why it took so long from taking the sample to actually getting the result, because the human genome is big.
Mm-hmm. That's so interesting. I have waited for results for a long time on different occasions, and I used to think, it can't take that long. It's done in Manchester. It's upstairs. Can't they just take it up there, bring it back down, and tell me? And they'd say, oh, no, it could take a week, 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And I couldn't picture it. I just didn't understand it until my genetic counselor actually took me around the lab, and I was like, oh, I get it now. It's not just... And you want to speed things up because it is your life, and a week seems, or 2 weeks seems like a lifetime. So I understand.
We are much faster now.
Yeah, good.
How fast?
Depends on what the test is, but I'll tell you what. This is actually when the first human genome was done, and it was mentioned earlier. And this took more than 10 years for this to be published in 2001, to read basically the 130 books that are with us today. Nowadays, this can be done in a few days.
Gosh.
And it costs so much less than what it costed at that time.
And what do you think is the, not the negative impact of that, but the fact that we're all hearing about that we can kind of, soon we'll be able to, the 23andMe is it called, or we can go out and get a genetic test from our local pharmacy, or I know Sasha's probably slightly bulking at this, but in terms of, you know, eventually many of us can go anywhere and we'll be able to get a genetic test and be able to find out very quickly. What do you think the impact of that is going to be on us and the people in this room or us as a society?
I guess one of the biggest things, I guess, that we think about is how much about the human genome that we don't know. And so I guess where we've focused our efforts are kind of really finding out about the parts that can make a difference to people's lives. And I guess that's not always appreciated because people don't understand how much information is in there. That actually when you go off and get these pieces of information, how much of it is actually useful? How much of it is actually going to make a difference to your life? And how much of it is actually just going to cause you lots of anxiety and lots of uncertainty and lots of kind of not understanding what that's for? So I think it's great that people are interested in science and interested in their DNA, but also I feel like it's a big kind of ethical and moral question about what we as a people want to do with that information, what we want to use it for.
I totally agree with that. And I think especially for genetic counselors, they get a lot of people panicked because they went and did a test and they have a result that telling them something will happen to them. Some of it will be not actually evidence-based. A lot of what we do in a medical center like here is driven by evidence, driven by research, while some of the results they get are not driven by evidence and research, and they come panicking to genetic counselors or to GPs or to other medical professionals, and they say, I got this, I don't know what to do with it. And that's why it's really important before someone does these genetic tests that are available directly to people to think about it very carefully and about what might happen when they get the results. And that's really, really important.
I don't know, shall we continue with that?
Sorry, we interrupted you.
Yeah.
I can save the question for a little bit. But because now we are in that, and the ethical theme is really important, and
yes.
I guess it's even more important in working as a genetic counselor,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
that you're sitting there with lots of questions.
Mm-hmm.
And in families, there will be people that they will want to know more information, and there will be people that in the same family that might not be interested in that. So how do you sit with people with these dilemmas?
Yeah, I guess it's a little bit about kind of what I mentioned before about getting to know the person, getting to know who they are and what kind of the need for the information is. So you will meet largely people in the clinic who some people need information and it makes them feel better. The knowing is what makes them feel better. And for some people, the knowing is actually what causes them anxiety. So sometimes the first part of that is actually just trying to help somebody to figure out what type of person are you? What bit of this information do you want to have? some of it's timing. So actually, at some point in your life, the knowing might be everything that you want, and at other times, it might not be. So again, it's talking very much about timing of things as well. Did you ask me anything else, or if I answered it?
I was going to ask, today you've done a brilliant job, both of you, at making it accessible, you know, so that so that we can all understand it, even me, and I'm not very good with the science at all. But how important is it to make that information accessible so that people, you know, any one of us in the room, the girls, can understand a little bit about how we're made and who we are?
I think it's really important. I think this knowledge is powerful. First of all, we need more people doing these things. So we need more children to be interested in science, in genetics, in genetic counseling, and all of this. And we need them to know that it's not hard. If I can do it, many people can do it. So really, they need to know that scientists are not very special, different people behind lab coats. And you've seen the lab coats downstairs. You can wear them. You can be the scientist. And I think once we get them excited about the science, about the background, about what a human genome is, I think we want to encourage them to become a scientist, a genetic counselor, to take part in this exciting, amazing journey of the human genome and how it affects everyone.
But you were saying, Sasha, a minute ago, in relation to this, that people feel empowered when doing...
Yes.
Can you say a little bit more about that?
I was itching to say a bit more
about
that.
Say then.
So that's what's really important for me, and that's kind of why I've come from a science communication background, is that we're talking about using this information to improve our health and the health of our families and our future. And so a lot of people that come through our doors have come because they've asked the question. They've asked the question about their family. Does this mean something that lots of people have had cancer in my family? Does it mean something that my child is struggling in school? And so being able to appreciate that we are here as a service and that there are questions that you can ask requires understanding. And so, you know, people talk a lot about kind of genetic literacy and actually just helping people to understand what genetics means and what genetic medicine is means that we can help more people because they will come and find us as well. I strongly believe that knowing about science and knowing about genetics empowers people to make choices over their own lives.
We are live at the Whitworth Gallery, and we are joined with Sasha and George and some of the children that enter our Rare D art competition. We're having a conversation about just how rare are we all?
And in terms of family, so my daughters will be the third generation of possible patients for you, or that will come in and at least want to speak to a genetic counselor. How important is that kind of knowing about what's in our family history and where we, you know, what's in our genes and where we come from? And so often, and I know in my family, it can often become an urban myth. So, you know, it's almost like, you know, I have achondroplasia, and it's like, well, there was somebody a long time ago in the family that had achondroplasia, so maybe it comes from that. So, and it's not very empowering. So how important is it for us to know about who's in our family and how it might affect us?
Yeah. Shall I do it again? So I guess there's two ways of looking at that. Is actually, if you don't understand, I guess, what the impact of things are in your family, sometimes people can feel very anxious about what's in their family and very worried that it means more than it does. So sometimes understanding what things mean in your family can be empowering in that way, that actually it can make you know that things are not that different. So, you know, one of the things we see lots of cancer families, and actually kind of explaining to people how cancer can behave in a family and whether that's more or less than is usual can be quite empowering for some people. So sometimes they just go away feeling really reassured, and that's an amazing thing to be able to give to people. It's nice to know what's in your family. There are, you know, we're an NHS service, and so our services are directed to people based on need, and sometimes you demonstrate that need by knowing about your family and knowing about what's happened in your family. So I know for previous generations, people didn't really talk about things, and they were myths, and, you know, people didn't really know what happened, and so-and-so died of a broken heart, and, you know, stories kind of get passed down, and maybe, we didn't really investigate or ask about those because you didn't ask your elders about those things. And so I think that's changing as well, and that we talk more in families and know more about our families, so that when you come to services like genetics and we can talk about your family, you can talk with authority about kind of what's happened, and that helps us jointly to come to something and for you.
I think it's also not only about families. We know that we do some groups sometimes, and,
yes,
and people are surprised to other people,
yes,
that they are living the same condition or... I don't know whether this is something that you're doing more or is more available now in terms of ethics as well. It used to be like this is very private lives, mm-hmm, and this goes with the culture and the territory sometimes. But I'm just wondering what we're doing here, or I'm not sure if you do more things outside for the public to be okay about sharing that,
yeah,
they live with a certain condition, mm-hmm, maybe visible or maybe not visible.
Yeah, yeah. I think that change in society about talking about things has kind of filtered through into lots of ways. And so we as counsellors spend a lot of time talking to people about what support groups they might want to go to, about what organisations they might want to be involved in, because there are just some really fantastic kind of support groups and patient-led organisations that really speak loudly about who they are and why they're special, why they're different and what they need. And so I do think that that really does help people as well, because they often, you know, come to this daunting building on the sixth floor, and it's a clinic where we're seeing people through all different conditions. So sometimes you can still sit in that room and think, I'm the only one that looks like this in here. And actually to be able to help someone to find their tribe is quite nice as well.
The tribe, you say.
And I've noticed actually a shift in terms of the science side of that, in terms of the fact that as scientists and as the people in the lab, that you're also interested in the family and kind of, and how this result. I remember when I had my second daughter, she doesn't have the achondroplasia gene, but my whole family does. And it was commented, whoever did the test, my language around this is very naive, so excuse me, George, but whoever did the test commented that, oh, I wonder how this information is going to impact this family.
Yeah.
And I just, that's really stuck with me in terms of that somebody that was doing the science part was still thinking about the culture of my family and how that would work.
Yeah, I think that's really important because, again, scientists working in the lab, all what we see is a tube with DNA in it. And if you look at it, you'll think there's a drop of water in there. And it's really important for us to remember there's a human, there's a family, there's a story. There's a story that could be going for generations because this is a genetic disease. So remembering that every single sample comes from a person, and that person comes from a home, and there are people who love and care about that person, makes you treat this sample differently. You're not treating just a drop of water. You're treating the life of a person, the life of a family. That's been going on for generations.
I would like you to be my teacher on that. If I would, yeah. So, but I'm wondering, how did you kind of connect with that in this way? You know, I imagine myself as well that you do these trainings and you learn in a very scientific way, and this is not something that you learn easily. So who would have transmitted that to you, this idea of taking the that there is a person behind, a family with ideas, with dreams, with hopes?
I think the way that clinical scientists are trained now, we have a lot of parts where we get exposed to patients in the training. So we speak closely with our genetic counselor colleagues, with our clinical geneticists. When we're training, we sometimes attend some of the clinics in order to see the patient. Then you know that the sample is coming from that patient. And a lot of it comes from public engagement, because you're meeting the patients, you're meeting the public, you're meeting the people who are worried about their results, you're meeting the people who want to know that their DNA sample was tested correctly, was treated well, was done to the best of our knowledge. And that's why when you connect that sample to a human being, to a life, to a story, you do deal and treat the sample differently, and you do it with the best that you can.
Yeah. Can I beat the drum for Manchester a little bit?
Yes, definitely.
I think one of the... So I guess we were talking a bit about kind of direct-to-consumer tests, and George spoke a little bit about how much care that we treat our samples with, and how much evidence-based medicine we kind of use in our practice. So I guess in terms of the gold standard of what you get out of genetics, coming to a department of like in Manchester, that's what you're really getting. But also it's the fact that we all work there together. So the consultant geneticists, the genetic counsellors and the scientists, we are all on the same floor, in the same department. If I get a piece of information that I don't understand, I walk down the corridor and I go and speak to a scientist. If a report is late and I have a pregnant lady who's worried and she needs that, I can speak to a scientist and say, this is what's happening for my lady. I need to talk to her and explain this. How is this test going? Why has it failed? Why is it not working? And so there's this real kind of respect for each other and what each other does that comes through in what we do as counsellors. So helping people understand why something takes so long is because I understand what George does. And so that comes through when I'm speaking to families. And then for scientists, what is happening for the family happens because they have such close contact with us. And so that's why I think it's a really special genetic environment to be working in.
And that's really important because when you send a sample to a direct consumer testing lab, there's lots of information missing out there. Because sometimes when I'm testing this sample, and I have a set of information about it, sometimes it doesn't fit, or I find something at some that thing for it to make sense, it needs that a little bit more information. Yesterday, I went to speak to one of the clinical geneticists because I was missing a bit of information that will make the whole difference between this change being a meaningless change to a change that might affect the disease in this family. And after I spoke to my colleague, just walked down the corridor, spoke to her, she went back to the patient's pictures and actually said, yes, this is there in this patient. And we were able to make more sense out of that genetic change that we found. And that genetic change now is going to inform the treatment and the care of this patient.
Is it possible to say what kind of little thing can be that? Just, it can be...
So sometimes it's as simple as, well, the referring clinician says this patient has a learning disability or this patient has a big head. Sometimes how big
can make
big
a difference.
Is can make a big difference. Or what type of learning difficulty they have? Because learning difficulty is a big word.
So it's very personalized.
It's a very personal. And that's why, you know, they keep calling it personalized treatment, personalized care, because the DNA sequence, that DNA change, some of these DNA changes can only be found in certain families. And sometimes you not only have to talk to clinicians in our lab, we have a lot of, because working in the NHS is so unique, we have meetings with scientists and clinicians from all over the NHS. We have some of these regular meetings once a month over a phone call, and we discuss some of these difficult cases. And you find a rare case in Manchester that you're struggling to understand, actually, there's another rare case in Cambridge or another case somewhere else in the world. And we talk about these, we share the information, and we get a better outcome for the patients here in Manchester and elsewhere.
Okay. Thank you very much. I would like to know whether you have some questions. Do you have some questions for them? You? Yeah?
How many cells are there in one genome?
Now, you're looking at me. You're looking at me, but I definitely won't be able to answer that question. But I'm sure that George might be able to answer that question.
Did you mean how many genes are there in one cell? So the books that are downstairs are the human genome, and there are a lot of letters. So if we put a number, it's 3.2 billion letters, and that's a very, very big number. And in terms of genes, we have more than 20,000 genes in that DNA sequence. And these books, there are two copies of them in almost every cell of your body. So every small cell of your body has two copies of that books.
Wow.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
You guys have any questions? I'm going to keep listening for a little bit longer. There'll be more chance for questions at the end as well. I wanted to ask either one of you, how important the people in this room are, mm-hmm. and then obviously that will extend out to how important the people in Manchester are and how important society is to keep this conversation going and to keep people engaged.
Very. So it really is. It's just so nice to see so many people, actually, who are interested to find out what we're doing and interested to tell us what RARE means to them. And that's kind of just how this conversation spreads, isn't it? That it will be the people who are here today talking about the people that they know, who talk to the people that they know. And it's that thing that we were talking about that is different as we are, we're also the same. And so, you know, people are able to talk to people who are like them about this thing that they went to. And what I really like about this day is the different kind of layers that it's had, that there are some really simple activities that young people can do that they can engage with. There are different professions here that older people have been able to come and talk to us about how to be a genetic counsellor or do I want to be a scientist. So I just think on all levels, it's been really great. Yeah.
Can you hear me? Yeah. I think, again, it's really interesting because I would love more and more people, when people come here, to know that science is not difficult. Mm. So when you go downstairs and do the jigsaw with Jonathan, that's more or less what we do. We're looking at different pieces of the puzzle. We put them together, and it makes the whole difference. And it is really, really good to see the children. All the children that I asked, do you know what this is or what DNA is? And they all knew it. So it's just amazing. Yeah, yeah. And most of them knew that it's A, C, T, G, four letters. And I was really, really inspired to see all the children engaging with the human genome, with the DNA sequence. It's just an eye-opener.
And I think that's really evident. A young friend of mine, Isla, is here today, and she was really interested. I don't know who was talking to her about the X and Y, and really engaged with that and was taking that all in, even though she's such a young age. And I think you remember things like that, and it kind of stays with you as you're growing up, and that kind of information, and also not just the information, but the way it was communicated to you in a positive way and in a way that can be shared, I think is really important.
There's something, some people have this, or we heard that in our podcast, people might think that by knowing your genome, the full information, you can predict who you are or how you are, and I don't believe it's the case. But
I strongly don't believe that.
You strongly don't believe that. How can we share that? Or how would you, why you don't believe that?
So this is a very, very old question. Mm. It's nature versus nurture. And people talk about it all the time. I always believe that the DNA sequence gives us a lot of instructions. It impacts our lives a lot, but it doesn't determine everything. And the way we live, the way we interact, the way we respond, just makes a huge difference. From a personal experience, I love twins. That's one of the reasons why I wanted to do genetics. And I was blessed enough to have twins as my children. And and they cannot be any more different. They are treated the same from us. They have very similar upbringing. They have very similar environment. And they're so different from each other. So
you say you are a twin.
I have twins.
My children. He was
interested
in twins.
Oh. Twins. So they're so different, and genetics plays an important role. It's very, very important, but it does not determine everything.
You are.
No, it doesn't define you. It is part of what defines you, but it's not the whole story.
We hope you are enjoying the podcast so far. Please subscribe, rate, and review. Continue to follow our conversations where we discover that RARE means different things to different people.
And how would you, that must be quite an integral part of how you communicate results to people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I guess, you know, you're thinking about the things that you say often to people. So I guess giving a result, you would say often to people that actually, who you are is who you are, and most of the information that we find out, that's what you were born with. So there's nothing about this information that's going to change who you are. It might change what you do about this piece of information, but you're going to be the same person yesterday as you are today now that I've given you that piece of information. So we have a very big appreciation that, you know, there is so much that goes into who you are, that we're talking about often one gene out of 20,000 of them. So it kind of doesn't even make sense that your genetics would be everything of who you are. We see families, so, you know, we see twins all the time, we see people all the time, and I've never met two people that are the same. So, yeah.
I was going to ask you actually to talk a little bit more about that, because you mentioned something earlier, George, about, you know, us all, for instance, all the girls sat on the table and us, just how the same or how different are we?
So, we'll see if anyone with good math is here. So, we have a big human genome. Like I said, it's 3.2 billion letters, but we are very unique. So if we look around the table, we are have different hair colors, styles. Some of us don't have hair to start with. Some of us are short, some of us are tall. So we're very different, we're very unique. And if we look, if we sequence my genome, and if we sequence your genome and we compare them together, we will find a lot of differences, okay? We will find more than 3 million differences, okay? So that's how unique you are, and everyone will have that number of differences. But because the human genome is so big, okay, 3 million out of the human genome is very little. So as much as we are unique and different, we actually share more than 99%. So we are exactly, you don't need to be a twin or anything like that. Any two in this room here today share more than 99% of their DNA. So we are unique, we are different, but we share a lot more than what we differ in. And that's really important to remember.
Why is this important to you personally?
I think it's important in many ways, and especially for people with rare disease, because they can find themselves different. They sometimes can find themselves unique, but they need to remember, or the people around them need to remember, that yes, they are different, they are slightly different than us, but me and them share a lot. And that's really important with how people connect to each other. We do share a lot between us.
I think what we're doing here, it's part of reminding people that we are more similar than different. Mm-hmm. And hopefully that has an effect in the way we see each other. Mm-hmm.
And the way that we interact with each other and respect each other. And I think particularly for young people who sometimes go through, if they have a rare genetic condition, or even if they don't, but they just feel a bit different to all of their friends or to the people around them, I think it's such a good message to think, we are actually all quite the same.
Yeah.
I don't know whether you want to answer my question that I did kind of before. The question about how were you inspired to come to this kind of job personally?
The story.
Yeah.
The story. Start
who wants to start?
Yeah, Sasha likes to start all the time.
And the leader.
Go, Sasha.
So how did I get here? So I spoke a little bit about liking science when I was young, and
was that as a girl?
As a girl.
Was that any different? Was it hard to kind of find your space in science, or?
I think as a girl, as a black girl. Yeah. Being academic is maybe not necessarily what people expect of you to do, particularly in sciences. So the higher up you got in science, the more I became unique, more I became the only. So I guess there was always that. And then the story behind how I got into genetic counselling was after working in kind of science communication and patient engagement for a while, I met a genetic counsellor on my 30th birthday at an event. And I was leaving because I never work on my birthday. So I was only staying for breakfast and then I was about to go. And I spoke to this counsellor who works at Manchester, and I spoke to her about what I do and essentially about the values that I enjoy in what I do. I enjoy science, I enjoy empowering people, and I always want to work with people, and I don't know where next I go with that. And she said, have you thought about genetic counselling? And I was like, oh, don't you need to be some very clever person who'd done loads of things before you do that? And she was like, what have you done? And I told him, she was like, no, you can do this. And so I applied and was on the course the very next year, and I've been working in Manchester ever since with that same counsellor who told me to do the job on my 30th birthday. And I think I've been in Manchester 10 years now.
For me, it's actually started much earlier. I wasn't very good at school. I was a child who caused a lot of problems and did not keep... I wasn't attentive at school. I wasn't very good. And 1 year, we had a new biology teacher. And one of the things that he taught us about was how DNA gives RNA... and RNA gives protein, and then protein makes us. And it just, it caught my attention. And he was so good. He taught with such passion, with such love to science and biology, and that was the only subject that made me listen, made me sit. So since then, I did tell him, I was 12 years old at the time, I said, I want to do this, I want to do the DNA. And since then, I wanted to become a geneticist, I wanted to do genetics, and he always told stories about twins and their genetics, nature and nurture, and just loved the whole thing. So since then, I wanted to become a geneticist.
Does he know that you are here?
He knows that I'm a geneticist now, yes, he does.
And how do you think he thinks of you?
It's amazing, because he did play a very important role in changing my life. If he hasn't inspired me at school, I don't know where I would have been now. Mm. Because if you were a teacher, you didn't want me to be in your class. No. I was such a problematic student.
I'm sure very unlike the girls that
yes.
are at the table.
Yes.
But I wanted to actually ask the girls about, obviously you all go to school, and what you... are thinking about you might like to do when you're older?
When I'm older, I think I might like to be in an infectious diseases doctor.
Okay.
Wow.
That was not the answer I was expecting, but very relevant, so brilliant.
What about?
When I'm older, I would like to be a vet.
Oh, good.
I would like to be a vet too.
Lovely.
Perfect.
Lots of science.
Lots of science. And one thing that you're better at this question than me.
Am I?
The rare question.
Okay. So we will start with the girls too. Is that okay? We would like to ask you one last question. We've been, and I don't pronounce that word very well, but keep being with me. We would like to know, what does rare means to you? If it doesn't need to be in relation to what we've been talking today, but in general, what if you hear the word rare, what comes to your mind?
Uncommon.
Uncommon. Thank you very much. What about you?
Impossible.
Impossible.
Not normally seen.
Not normally seen.
Now it's hard to top, but we're now going to ask you two the same question. You had a little bit of time to think about it, because you might have listened to the podcast, but George, we'll start with you. When you think of rare, and almost not just from a science, just from, you know, looking through the long lens of your life, if you think of rare, what do you think about?
I always think of rare. When I hear the word rare, I think of something unique and something very special.
Yeah, I think those are my two words, really, kind of special and unique. We spoke a lot about the similarities that we have, but I think one of the beautiful things about being rare or special or unique is about what that brings. And so that's what I always think, you know, when you're the rare thing, about what is the special thing that you're bringing to the table.
Because you're kind of saying the same thing.
Yeah.
Do you have an image that comes to you?
An image?
An image, yes. So maybe we see a bit of a difference between the two similar ways of seeing what rare is.
It's like being at school again.
Yeah.
I think of like maybe a cactus in a desert.
A what?
Say it again. Cactus in a desert.
A cactus in a desert. Oh, yeah. That's nice.
There you go. It's an image.
That's a good one.
Well, just now, because you put me on the spot.
Yes.
One of the best things I like is olives and olive trees. And I think finding olive trees in England is something very rare.
Very. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Oh. I've got an olive tree in my garden.
Wow. I have one in my kitchen. Wow.
So it's not rare, not after rare. All. So it completely fits in. Brilliant. Well, thank you so much, everyone around the table, for joining in this conversation. And everyone, we're now going to give the opportunity, actually. I don't know if anybody does have any questions, but lovely Anthony, and I don't know if Penny's still around. We might have some questions from our audience to anyone sat around the table.
This is scary.
Because this could be anything.
This could be anything. Okay.
Very quiet.
Maybe we've covered everything. There's just no more That's questions fine. Left.
That's fine. Oh.
In terms of global research with the Human Genome Project, with a lot of places working together, do you ever worry about sort of companies and countries influencing how people communicate in terms of research and wanting to keep information to themselves?
I think certainly that's a worry of how people might misuse the information or keep some of the information to themselves. But I think one thing that scientists and clinical people working in genetics are good at is sharing information. Because without that information that we share together, with some of the very rare genetic changes, we may never find the answer if we don't share information. So it might happen, but we encourage sharing information a lot.
Hi, everybody. I just wondered where you thought the next innovation or the next big discovery relating to genetics and DNA may come from. You know, is there some scientific exploration going on somewhere in the world to find the next level of scientific discovery?
I will say what I think is missing, and we really need to understand more. And I actually had a conversation earlier with someone about this. But the human genome, we work in a clinical lab, and a lot of research goes around what we call the coding DNA, or the genes that are 20,000 odd genes. They're a very, very small part of our human genome. They're actually, you can stretch it to 1 to 2% of that. And that's the part that we really, really understand. In the past, the rest of it used to be called junk DNA because we thought it does nothing. But actually, it holds a lot of the information. It plays an important role in regulating and organizing the rest of the genome. So I think understanding the genetic variation within the non-coding DNA is very important.
I wanted to ask the genetic counselor, what is a reason for someone who's got a parent with a genetic disease of themselves wanting to know whether they carry that gene or not if there's no treatment?
What is the purpose?
No, what's a reason for them wanting to know as opposed to not?
Yeah. So I guess we spoke a little bit about kind of knowing and not knowing whether that causes you anxiety or not. So sometimes even when there's not a treatment, living knowing that something may or may not happen can cause people a lot of anxiety, a lot of thought and a lot of energy to worry about this thing that might happen or might not happen. And so sometimes framing that a little bit better for people helps them to adjust, helps them to make choices in their life about what they might want to do and when, if they know that this is something to worry about or not worry about. And even though things might not necessarily have a treatment or a cure, often there's a management of symptoms. So sometimes knowing about something means that you can screen for it so that you can pick it up early if it happens, or that you could take a preventative medication that would slow down the course of something happening. Even when there might not necessarily be a cure to something, there are always all sorts of reasons that people might want to know about it.
If I may ask just one more slightly probably tricky question. So if a person does not want to know and is not affected at that time, but their children would like to know, what do you do?
It's a big question in genetics, and it happens a lot. Often with things that are adult onset, it does happen because parents who are still fit and well for something that might not yet have happened, they might have adult children who do want to know. We facilitate communication within families. Once people understand the genetics and how knowing might reveal the answer in a family, that sometimes helps families to be able to communicate because they understand the case. We also feel as a professional responsibility that the person who doesn't want to know is aware that we cannot withhold someone else from finding something else out, and that might therefore reveal your genetic status. And are you happy with that? So we give people the opportunity to either say that they're happy that that family would keep it within their family, they're happy for their genetic status to be revealed in that way, or often what happens is that they're happy to therefore find that information out for the helpfulness of other people in the family. Even though they might not necessarily want to do anything with it themselves, they're happy to find out that information to help other people in the family.
So I think that's all of the questions. Do we have another? Oh, Fiona, do you have a question?
Here today, and we've talked a lot about genetics and a lot about illness, and one of the things we have talked about is how in the near future we might all find out a lot more about our own status. So in terms of thinking about the children here today, what do we think is the most important message to get to children if someone in their school or their friend turns around and says, I have a genetic condition? What do you think are the main things children need to understand about what that means? So I guess the idea behind it is we have a lot of children in here today, and they may well come across a friend in school who says to them, I have a genetic condition. What do we think the basic message is that children should know about what a genetic condition means in terms of interacting with their friends?
Yeah, sure. So I feel like it's a lot of what we've spoken about already, about how similar we are. And actually, if somebody tells you that they have a genetic condition, I think George has told us in all sorts of ways what that actually means and what a tiny difference it is really in all of their genetic story. So it doesn't change them being your friend or who they were, but it might mean that there's something very rare or special about them that you might need to understand a bit more about.
Thank you. Thank you to everyone for being here today and for coming to join us at the Whitworth and for our first ever live podcast. We still connect it, I think. But thank you so much.
I hope you enjoyed listening to our live podcast. We were talking about all things rare. Genomics and the future of genomics affects us all. It is important we have our say for us and our families. Visit the RareD website and social media channels to continue the conversation.